Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Rabbi Chaim Herring, discussing fixing today's synagogues. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's now the post-football month of February when America's attention returns to kvetching about the weather, except here in Arizona where I live. And what exactly? Well, since this is a month in which we used to celebrate the births of our two most famous and important presidents, I thought I'd focus a little on just what the American land of freedom and opportunity has meant to my people. What is it that makes America unique? As Americans, we pride ourselves on many things: the size and beauty of our country, the power of our military, our scientific and technological innovation, the vigor and creativity of our popular culture, the dominance of our athletic teams, the extraordinary dynamism and popularity of our entertainment industry's creations. We used to brag about our robust economy, too, and maybe this will be the year we finally get to do that again. But above all, what has always set America apart has been the official ideals embodied in our formative documents and inscriptions, and recited and sung in our patriotic hymns. We are officially the land of the free, the sweet land of liberty, lifting its lamp beside the golden door of equal opportunity and guaranteed rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is that official dedication to having a country in which anyone can rise to the level of his or her ability and drive that has made America a magnet for the talented and discriminated against people of the world, the place where individual ability and determined effort can build a good life in a land of opportunity and, most of all, freedom, where success is solely dependent on talent and effort. None of that, of course, explains the Kardashian sisters, who seem to lack both talent and effort and yet continually succeed. But I digress. The ideal of America has always been that it's the country where your rise or fall is dependent not on who you know, but what you know, not which family or clan you belong to, but what your ideas and abilities achieve, not on what religion you practice, but on what you contribute to society. Our first president, George Washington, and our greatest president, Abraham Lincoln, embodied those values. I have to admit that the whole concept of President's Day remains odd to me. When I was a child in elementary school back in the 60s and 70s, February was a great month because we had 2 4-day school weeks. Lincoln's birthday and Washington's birthday were both holidays, and we got both of them off of school. It was great. 2 consecutive short weeks. Then, demonstrating that perfect American ability to use any excuse to improve our leisure time experience, both holidays became 3-day weekends for a while, and we had 2 consecutive 3-day weekends. Yippee! Then, sometime in the last few decades, we added the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, and that apparently required that we combine the birthdays of our two greatest presidents, or so historians tell us anyway, into one President's Day holiday. Here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, even that holiday is only semi-celebrated because we have our rodeo break coming up in a couple of weeks, and schools and lots of businesses are still in session during President's Day. So our president's birthdays are not quite what they once were. I remember when cherry pies were in every supermarket. Remember that story about George Washington's contretemps with a fateful cherry tree? And there were displays of Lincoln and Washington everywhere. Well, I also remember thinking in those days that it was odd that we celebrated Lincoln's birthday before Washington's, since he was actually born after Washington had died. You know, Lincoln's real birthday was February 12th, 1809. Now, Washington's birthday is actually a little more complicated. He was born February 11th, 1731, on the then-used Julian calendar. But when he was 21 years old, Britain and her colonies shifted to the more accurate Gregorian calendar, and George's birthday moved to February 22nd in his own lifetime. It was called old-style and new-style calendars. In any case, Washington's closest connection to the Jewish people came in an incredible exchange of letters between our first president and the important Touro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island. Its temple building is colonial and still in use. It's lovely, by the way. I participated in services there once. Anyway, in 1790, George Washington visited Rhode Island, and his letter to the Hebrew congregations of Newport includes this timeless phrase, more or less borrowed intact from the original letter sent to him by Moses Seixas of that congregation. Washington wrote, "Happily, the government of the United States gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens, in giving it on all occasions their effectual support." A beautiful and very important statement against bigotry on the ideals of America from our first president. Additionally, this year we will mark the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, and of course, in April, that means the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination. It occurred on Pesach, Passover, by the way. As an amateur Lincoln enthusiast, I have to note that Lincoln had very significant Jewish connections that had an important impact on Jewish history in America. Of course, Lincoln eventually freed the slaves in America, just 150 years ago or so now, by the way, a kind of eye blink in world historical time, forever linking Lincoln with Moses as the great liberators of human history. But while some cranks think that Lincoln was Jewish, he was certainly not, there is certainly a significant thematic connection nonetheless. In practical terms, Lincoln, like Queen Elizabeth, had a Jewish physician. In his case, a podiatrist whom he saw regularly and liked very much and even used as a kind of spy on the South. The Emancipation Proclamation itself was sent out by a Jewish telegraph operator, Edward Rosewater, with whom Lincoln spent a fair amount of time during the Civil War sitting around waiting news and sending out cables himself. But certainly, and most significantly, in the only recorded incident of federally sanctioned bigotry against Jews, it was Lincoln who stood up instantly and emphatically to protect Jewish rights and liberties. On December 17, 1862, the great Union general Ulysses Grant issued General Orders No. 11, which expelled all Jews from his district, included Kentucky, Tennessee, and Mississippi. Grant cited trade regulation violations. Although Grant had no previous record of anti-Semitism and had close Jewish friends and supporters, including Joseph Seligman, an important financial advisor, Grant was provoked by the black market in southern cotton and illegal traders, some of whom were Jewish and some of whom had dealings with his own father. Old prejudices flourished, and Jewish practices became linked to profiteering, at least in Grant's mind. He may also have been drinking too much at the time, as he often did when his campaigns bogged down or turned into sieges. In any case, it was a disastrous order. It resulted in Jews who had long lived and worked in the large regions suddenly being expelled from their homes and businesses. Jewish leaders from around the country telegraphed President Lincoln, condemning the act as a violation of the Constitution and of the rights of citizenship. Jewish officers in the Union Army also appealed to Lincoln. One of them resigned. After meeting with a Jewish delegation from Paducah, Kentucky, and from Cincinnati, Ohio, Lincoln immediately requested that Union Commanding General Henry Halleck order Grant to revoke General Orders No. 11, which he did January 6, 1863. Rabbi Isaac Meir Weiss, leading founder of American Reform Judaism and the editor of the Jewish paper The Israelite, was part of a delegation that called on Lincoln that day to thank him for rescinding the order. Lincoln expressed his sincere belief in the illegitimacy of condemning an entire class. He would not allow anyone to be wrong due to religious affiliation. As Wise later recalled, the president gave utterance to his surprise that General Grant should have issued so ridiculous an order and added, "To condemn a class is, to say the least, to wrong the good with the bad. I do not like to hear a class or nationality condemned on account of a few sinners." The president fully illustrated to us that he knows of no distinction between Jew and Gentile, that he feels no prejudice against any nationality, that he by no means will allow that a citizen is to be wronged on account of his place of birth or religious confession. Yet another example of the true greatness of the best of our presidents, Abraham Lincoln, in this small Jewish window into his character. So, this coming week, happy birthday, AB Baby.
Happy birthday, AB Baby. Happy birthday to you. Yeah! Happy birthday, AB Baby. Happy birthday to you.
We celebrate these two great presidents and the important role they played in our people's freedom to enjoy the many gifts of this great country and to contribute to its greatness. To play us in this fine morning, here's a setting by Rabbi Moshe Rothblum for Adon Olam, the hymn praising the greatness of God with a recitation of God's attributes and our connection to God. That was Rabbi Moshe Rothblum's Adon Olam. The oldest surviving institutional structure in the Jewish world is the synagogue. It has kept Judaism alive and flourishing for more than 2,000 years. But things in 21st century America are changing, and it isn't exactly clear just what the future holds for the one Jewish organization that is absolutely essential for our religion and culture to exist for future generations. Find out from an expert, Rabbi Chaim Herring, just how and why temples are changing today and how they might look in the future when we come back here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. and this, and even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome Rabbi Chaim Herring to Too Jewish This Morning. He is a consultant for synagogues and Jewish organizations who has innovative and interesting ideas about how not only we might thrive now, but do so in the future. His new book is called Keeping Faith in the Rabbis, a community conversation about rabbinical education. Good morning and welcome, Rabbi Herring.
Hi, good morning, Rabbi. How are you today?
Well, thanks. Synagogues have been around for, maybe 2,200, 2,300 years. What's different today about the way synagogues need to function?
Synagogues today have one challenge that I don't think any other generation has had, and that is the fact that there are four generations, soon to be five generations, given longevity today, that synagogues need to take into consideration in terms of tefillot, worship, and programming, and the possibility of bringing generations together. I mean, just think about that. Four generations in large numbers at one time for one institution. Unprecedented.
You know, rabbis have been around not as long as synagogues, interestingly, but for a very long time. We have been training rabbis in somewhat innovative ways, but are we doing a good job of teaching rabbis how to deal with 21st century Judaism, particularly in North America?
I'm going to break that question up into two different parts. With regard to what makes a rabbi authentic, which is Torah and Jewish wisdom and knowledge, I think the seminaries have different formulas for that, and I think that they're those are up for discussion and difference, but I think that seminaries are doing well at that. Your question about preparing, you know, rabbis for 21st century Judaism, I think may be beyond the seminaries. That is to say, there's so much that you can expect a seminary to do. What is the role of continuing rabbinical education, formal and informal mentorship, coaching, and great partnerships between rabbis and lay people to fill in those real-world gaps?
It seems as though loyalties and allegiances are not what they used to be in the American Jewish world. We're seeing millennials particularly get a bad rap for being non-joiners. They don't want to participate. Is that an accurate depiction, or is something else going on?
I think that it's maybe too easy of a definition to say that millennials are non-joiners. And I would definitely say that there is something else going on, and that is how the people identify today with communities. What is their self-identity? What does it mean to be able to belong not to just one or two communities, but to virtually any community, anytime, anywhere? And that, I think, is a much more fundamentally complex question, and one that will yield better results in terms of engaging millennials. I would quickly point out, though, that it's not just millennials who seem to be having this issue. We're also, I think, seeing some attrition on the part of boomers who were, quote, much more loyal to congregations than in the past.
I think that's true, and we'll continue to explore that question of why that is when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish with Rabbi Chaim Herring.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. We started talking last week about Freedom Smoke, the smokeless product, no tobacco, to get people off of cigarettes. What are the health advantages to using your product as opposed to smoking?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. We have a lot of physicians here in town, from neurologists to ophthalmologists, cardiologists, pulmonologists, sending patients to us because of damaging effects from emphysema, everything of the like that comes from smoking cancerous cigarettes.
And Freedom Smoke International provides all kinds of flavors, pleasurable experience, but not the same health risk.
That's right. You have the same experience as smoking. You have the hand-to-mouth, the mantra of the In-N-Out, as well as vapors compared to cigarette smoke. So there's no secondhand smoke either.
How can people find your product?
They can find us through freedomsmokeusa.com. Our toll-free number, which is here in Tucson, is 800-705-7013.
And then go into a store.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We have three stores. We're opening a fourth in the next couple of months here in town.
We will talk more next week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Wine Tribe Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
So last week we celebrated Tu B'Shvat, but we also this year are on the sabbatical year. We talked about the Shemitah, the sabbatical. I get to enjoy a four-month sabbatical as a rabbi after 7 years in my congregation. People think it's a great luxury. It is, in a way. And people at university level in America know about the sabbatical and how you can get sometimes a full year off of teaching. But in Israel, it's much more broadly based. Let's talk about what sabbatical means in Israel.
First, in Israel, you can feel you don't need to wait 7 years. Every seventh day, you have your own Shemitah.
Shabbat.
And you feel the Shabbat very, you know. But yes.
By the way, that means you should shut off your cell phone and get disconnected and not go on Facebook. But
yeah. Another mega trend in
Another
Israel.
Mega
yeah,
trend.
But in Israel, it's fascinating because every teacher from kindergarten to university have the right, and actually it's not just the right. I think they are obligated to take every seventh year a full year, like a school year off.
Wow.
And in one condition, that they will take some classes in university or whatever, just in order to really allow the growth, the spiritual and whatever.
And professional growth.
Professional growth, yes. So it's an amazing adaptation, you would say.
It is an adaptation.
Yeah.
So what a fascinating concept. So that's true. You don't have to be a university professor. And as you're a kindergarten teacher, a first grade teacher, eighth grade teacher, whatever it is, you get a full year off.
A full year. And I heard that, I know that you can only once give up the year and
defer
take the money. But only once.
Only one time.
Yeah, because if you're a teacher, you can't. You won't be so productive after more than 14 years without
That's so different from our American system, where in so many professions, including teaching, which does take a great deal of energy. Mm-hmm. I mean, otherwise you end up, I remember somebody saying you can have 20 years of experience, or you can have 1 year of experience 20 times. If you take a year off, that forces you to kind of renew what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You can't just pull the same thing out and do the same thing. Very different from our American system, in which you get 2 weeks of vacation. How does the sabbatical, you also mentioned that when we were talking last week, and we've talked a little bit about this too, this sabbatical has led people to kind of a course of personal growth, this Shemitah year in Israel, and that there are groups that are formed, have nothing to do with rabbis, in which people study for the sabbatical. Can you describe some of that?
Yeah, yeah. Just for instance, in the beginning of that year, they had like a huge, more than one, but a huge Shemitah conference led by secular people, like not one rabbi in the room, and they discussed Shemitah and I think they started from the region, like from our Torah, of course, but they took it and they allow all the audience to understand the so many implementation of the Shemitah, because it's
different,
not just
implementation
or implementation of the Shemitah, because
right.
it's related to debt and to slaves, and you know, in the old time,
yeah,
it's related
so
to so many things,
releasing debt, yeah. releasing slaves,
yes,
and that also, in addition to the economic egalitarian implications, also means letting yourself out of the kind of personal slavery that you,
yes.
the habits, the bad things that you end
yes.
up doing.
But the conference was, again, much more like in terms of spirituality and how you let things, how you stop smoking, starting reading, or the opposite, how you,
how you start
smoking and let go of the reading, not, you know. Everyone make their own choices.
What a remarkable way of renewal. We will talk next week. Thanks, Oshra.
Thank you.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There was an ADL study not terribly long ago surveying anti-Semitism in the world, and it came up with some wild conclusions. It's, you know, kind of a basic study, same thing they've been doing in America, which has shown American anti-Semitism declining pretty steadily for like 40-some years, almost 50 years. But this showed that Laos, which has had basically no Jews, has almost no anti-Semitism. And Korea, which has also had almost no Jews, as we talked about last week on the show, has a very high level of anti-Semitism. And it's just sort of this stunning thing. Like, how can that be? They're not that far apart from each other. Some of the conditions, at least from the Jewish perspective, are the same. So, you know, let's play with this a little bit, because it's a very odd and confusing thing, I think, for people.
Right. First of all, let me confess that I'm not at all familiar with this study. On the other hand, unlike some percentage of your listeners, I do know what ADL stands for, which
sorry,
is the
Anti-Defamation
League. Right.
Used to be the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith. It spun off to a separate right. institution. Abe Foxman is just retiring quite soon. And,
right.
Okay.
So what the D in that acronym stands for, defamation, we usually associate that word with the phrase defamation of character defamation. But in this case, it's defamation of the Jews as a people or as a nation. And the ADL used to jump all over cases, examples of particularly public high profile examples of any kind of defamation of Jews or Jewishness or Judaism or Jewish institutions. It's broadened its mission statement since its inception. And I was not aware that it now does studies like this on an international basis.
This was the first one, actually.
Okay. Well, since I don't know the content of the study, I and your listeners might benefit from a greater examination of what, I mean, you just mentioned two extremes, that Laos, which historically has no Jews, has no anti-Semitism. Korea, which also historically has no Jews, has a very high level of anti-Semitism. I would guess that's because Koreans are largely evangelical Christians who are not only anti-Semitic, but also anti-Catholic. They think that the Catholics hijacked the message of Christ and built corrupt institutions around it, which don't represent a truly Christian message. But that's
by the way, Korean peculiarity. Yeah, that's a Korean version, because evangelical Christians here certainly don't necessarily share those, either the anti-Semitism or the anti-Catholicism.
Some do, but many don't. Right. So I'd be interested, as I think your listeners might be, in hearing a little bit more about this study and some of the other countries it covered, if you don't mind.
Sure. You know, I remember it talked about the Arab world, and it said, you know, as you would expect, pretty high levels of anti-Semitism, diminishing a little in Turkey, but still fairly high. Greece had a very high level of anti-Semitism. Most of Western Europe, not particularly anti-Semitic. The United States, quite low. Latin America, a little higher. Again, with anomalies sort of all through parts of, you know, African countries that you wouldn't expect, had never known many Jews, high levels of anti-Semitism, maybe because they were Muslim, not always. You know, really a broad and sort of surprising array. And I think their methodology is okay. It's the same thing they've used in the United States. It's not super sophisticated or culturally, you know, localized, but it's just a very strange mix, and I think it will bear further study.
Interesting, because as I've been at pains to point out more than once on your show, Turkey is not an Arab country. It is a Muslim country.
Of course.
And one wonders if Muslim countries which are not Arab have a lower or higher rate of anti-Semitism.
Lower,
or if it's
not across
not
the board,
connected.
But generally lower, but not that much lower.
I think we're running out of time, but maybe next week we can talk about, I recently heard some interesting anecdotes about anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism in Indonesia, of all places. So
good one to talk about. We'll talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Shlomo and Moshe were talking one day about vacations. Shlomo says, "I think I'm just about ready to book my vacation again, but I'm going to do it differently this time. In the past, I took your advice about where to go. 3 years ago, you said go to Eilat. I went to Eilat. And my wife Ruth got pregnant. Then 2 years ago you said, no, go to Bermuda. And Ruth got pregnant again. Last year you suggested I go to the Caribbean. And as you know, Ruth got pregnant again." Moshe asks, "So what are you going to do different this year, Shlomo?" "This year," says Shlomo, "I'm taking Ruth with me." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And take her with you. And now a word of Torah. This week's Torah portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as any other one in the whole of the Torah. After the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic portions featuring some of the highlights in the whole of Jewish tradition, indeed, of all religious history, Mishpatim comes as a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder of Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us, and we miraculously crossed on dry land. And in the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians, and Pharaoh and Moses had their duel of wills in the desert. But Mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws about how to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. How exciting. How you handle someone else's property fairly. how to assess punitive damages for a man who injures another person or destroys somebody else's property, how to act when someone puts his or her property in trust with you, laws of manslaughter and theft and damages, boring laws, many of them tediously detailed. No one could possibly enjoy reading law books, can they? But if the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems too trivial. It can't belong in the Torah, can it? Why is Mishpatim here? You know, in general, human beings have no love of law, and often not of lawyers. But without laws, and without enforcement of laws, we fallible creatures wouldn't function well at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would likely tear each other apart. And where anarchy reigns, justice can't. That's where Mishpatim come in. For we need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one very much. Judaism understands that if we are to truly be good, or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency, embodied in the code of legislation that makes up Mishpatim. Because before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Before we can make this world holy, we must treat each other with civility. It is a great fundamental lesson we seem to need to relearn in every generation. A final note. At the end of this week's Parsha, after all of the rules and laws, the torts and talionises, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses. Why here? Well, because in this way, Mishpatim teaches us that we can only experience real holiness when we start by respecting our fellow men and women, when we come to understand that we are all in this together, and that the way to God is actually through the ways we learn to work together and come to trust one another. And we must do this in simple, practical, daily ways by following decent rules for human interaction. Poet Adrian Rich put it well. These atoms filmed by ordinary dust, that common life, freedom. It isn't once to walk out under the Milky Way, feeling the rivers of light, the fields of dark. Freedom is daily, prose-bound, routine remembering, putting together, inch by inch, the starry worlds. Freedom and holiness are dependent on the little laws established in Mishpatim, on the civility that rules require of us. May we all remember that this week and every week. I often say that if you take away all of the many worthy organizations in existence outside of Israel today, from the Jewish Federation to the Jewish Community Center to Hillel to APAC to J Street to the Jewish advocacy groups for many different causes, if you eliminated all of those organizations, God forbid, except for synagogues, you would still have Jews in 100 years. But if you preserved all the many wonderful Jewish organizations and eliminated only the synagogues, in 100 years there would be no Jews. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Chaim Herring, will explore just what synagogues and temples need to do today to flourish and succeed, the challenges they face, and how their rabbis and lay leaders need to change to cope with those challenges. Find out when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant.
Thursday is my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from our guest, Rabbi Sandy Seltzer.
In an exciting discovery, a clay tablet dating back over 1,000 years, documenting the Babylonian exile of Jews from ancient Palestine, is now on display at Jerusalem's Bible Land Museum. It puts a face on real people who went through these fateful events, says the museum's curator. The exile is commemorated each year on the Jewish fast day of Tisha B'Av and is recorded in the opening verses of Psalm 137, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat and wept as we remembered Zion." Researchers in Australia, working with researchers in Israel, are experimenting with a new strain of marijuana, which, if current tests prove successful, will, they say, alleviate the severe pain of those suffering from heart disease, diabetes, depression, and other illnesses far more effectively than what is currently in use. Moreover, they claim, it will also reduce the risks associated with using the drug for recreational purposes. After a 3-month absence and successful negotiations, the Jordanian ambassador to Israel has resumed his duties at the Jordanian embassy in Tel Aviv. His absence was a protest against what was viewed as the Israeli government's failure to curb unauthorized Jewish visits to the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque on Jerusalem's Temple Mount, these the third holiest sites in Islam. A German court has found a man shouting anti-Zionist insults during an anti-Israeli demonstration guilty of public expressions of anti-Semitism, which is banned by law in Germany. "Anti-Zionism," said the judge, "is the language of anti-Semites, a code for Jew. The case is on appeal, and it remains to be seen whether his ruling will be upheld." Germans and Jews alike are mourning the recent death of Richard von Weizsäcker, who was president of Germany for 10 years. In an address to the German people during his presidency, Weizsäcker said, "All of us, whether guilty or not, whether young or old, must accept the past. Anyone who closes his eyes to the past is blind to the present." In this country, Carl de Gerassi, who discovered the oral contraceptive known as the pill and was called the father of the pill, has died in San Francisco at the age of 91. An internationally renowned scientist, de Gerassi came to these shores as a 16-year-old Austrian Jewish refugee in 1939. While far too early to determine its success, a growing number of synagogues are moving away from financing their budgetary needs by mandatory dues payments to a system of voluntary pledges. A result, say observers of the Jewish scene, of the recession, different priorities of the younger generation, growing secularization, and the feeling that being a synagogue member should be based upon personal inspiration and religious commitment rather than a form of taxation. Finally, while there has been much concern recently over the possible deterioration of American-Israeli relationships, there is one positive note to report. It seems that the Israeli ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, and America's ambassador to Israel, Dan Shapiro, are both ardent New England Patriot football fans and were delighted over the Patriot victory in the Super Bowl. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world.
Our brothers, the house of Israel.
We welcome back our guest on Too Jewish this morning. Rabbi Chaim Herring is a consultant and expert on both the role of rabbis in synagogues, on synagogues today, on Jewish institutional life. His new book is called Keeping the Faith in Rabbis, a Community Conversation about Rabbinical Education, co-authored with Ellie Rosher. It's available now. Rabbi Herring, I want to ask you sort of one of my pet favorite comments and sort of offer it and see what you think. I have been saying for a long time that in one generation, with all of the wonderful Jewish organizations that we have in the world, particularly in North America, and there's so many different ways of expressing Jewish identity, if all of those organizations existed in one generation and synagogues did not, Judaism would disappear. And if all of those organizations, chas v'chalila, disappeared and synagogues remained, we would still have Jews. Is that an accurate reflection?
That is an intriguing question. And what you're hearing is a rabbi trying to just borrow a few seconds of time to unpack your question.
Imagine that.
I have a little bit of a bias. So my reflex is to say, of course, if it could only be one, it would be the synagogue, but it would have to be a different kind of synagogue. What synagogues can still do that no other kind of community can, at least at the moment, is they have the potential to grow with someone over a lifetime and to provide a sense of continuity and purpose and to give people an opportunity to see that what they can do as an individual, the power to be able to contribute to the world and to make it better is so much more impactful when there's a community of people with shared values that is underpinned by some sort of faith, however you want to describe that.
Rabbis have been challenged to succeed in their congregations, which means keeping membership up, balancing the budget, a lot of things that they may or may not actually be trained in. Do you think it's a reasonable expectation for the rabbi to sort of have the lead role in all of this? Is that always a shared responsibility? Does it vary from place to place?
I know that we're being recorded.
And broadcast.
You're now broadcast. That's right. You're now going to require me to make a statement that I wasn't prepared to make. Uh-huh. If I hear one more colleague say to me, with regard to some other movements, particularly Chabad, for example, well, they don't have to worry about paying the bills and keeping the lights on and doing those sort of administrative, fiscal kinds of things. And my response to that is, if you, Rabbi, if that's your primary worry right now, then maybe you should look at your structure of your congregation. And that's just not the rabbi's responsibility. I mean, it's lay people and rabbis. And I would say if that continues to be where you're putting your primary emotional energy, then maybe you shouldn't be in the congregation.
So if you were to create a congregation, your perfect ideal congregation and your perfect ideal rabbi, what would the leadership structure look like? How would it differ from a synagogue today?
This is not a soundbite answer. You're asking very excellent questions, Rabbi. I won't speak of ideals, but I'll speak about some contours. The rabbi and the congregational leadership would work together on really mapping out the vision and what does the ideal community together look like. What's that vision of the world that that congregation can create? And then, very generally, looking at the different kinds of talent available, what is it that the rabbi is uniquely suited to do? What is the educator or the chazan, the cantor, able to do? And the most overlooked potential that we have in congregations are lay people. They are extremely talented. Maybe they don't have rabbinic smicha or ordination, but they have lots of other talents that we're just not taking advantage of. So get the vision right, and then figure out who do you have who can best fulfill its different parts to create that powerful whole.
So I'm a Reform rabbi, although I'm also a conservative cantor, but primarily I've worked in the Reform movement for a long time. I can tell you that there are trends that pop up in which this is what good congregations, ideal congregations, best practices are. So for a while, it was empowering lay leadership in adult education, and then adult education might drive it. Then there was a focus on day school education as the salvation of Jewish education in America. Now it's distance learning. Services were supposed to be diverse so that there was a rich variety that people could choose from. Then there was an idea that we should shift back to just one way of doing services so that everybody could come back together. I've been doing this not that long. I mean, I'm older, but I'm not old yet. Has the velocity of change speeded up? What's going on?
Here's another difference between today and, I would say, past generations. And that is to say, how do we educate rabbis for a world in which disruption now seems to be the status quo? And I'm going to repeat that because I don't really know the answer to that question. This is a new phenomenon where the ability to have something that seems to be taking root suddenly be upended by the next newest thing is a new dynamic. And as rabbis, our job is to be faithful with the past, but also to make sure that there's a future. So, and I think that the kind of book like Keeping Faith in Rabbis, which is a community conversation, is what we need more of to open up the question to your kind of discussion that we're having now, Rabbi. It's the right question to ask. We can figure it out, but we won't figure it out by speaking in isolated silos, and that's why I was so intrigued with the idea of bringing these disparate conversations under one jacket cover.
It's a very interesting book. Where can people go to find out more about your work and about the book?
The book is available at Amazon.com. And when it first came out a few weeks ago, I was quite intrigued to see that it was the number one Jewish release, but also the number one release in Christian leadership, which tells me that the gods of big data either have a sense of humor, or this is not just a Jewish issue, it's an issue for faith communities that we're talking about.
Indeed.
And my website is Chaim Herring, HaimHerring.com.
I want to thank Rabbi Chaim Herring for a great visit here on Too Jewish. I think this is an ongoing conversation. We'll have to have you back when you've figured out all the answers.
We'll figure them out together, Rabbi. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Be well. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best.
To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be Abigail Pogrebin, journalist and author of the ongoing news series 18 Holidays, One Wondering Jew, and the book The Stars of David, which has been made into a terrific musical. Our playout this morning comes from Israeli star Rami Kleinstein, a past guest of Too Jewish. His song is Matanot Ketanot, Small Gifts. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Zeod Yom Shishi, no shemet avir, ha'o ve'atzel mesachakim shuv tofeset. Ha'shulchan aruch, tmunot yaldut al hakir, shayarot levanot chozrot mibet kneset. Ve'areach hazeh, shesoret li et alev. מתגנב, מתגנב, ופותח דלתות אל אושר קטן, אל אותו שיר ישן שעובר אצלנו במשך דורות. מתנות קטנות, מי שהוא שלח לי מתנות קטנות, רסיסים של קטנות.